So, I brought a hard topic tonight. How many of you like the name of that? You know, like that science and Genesis support program filling and not natural selection. The goal of this talk at the end is to knock away a bunch of false information about natural selection and replace it with a biblically correct and scientifically correct view of what actually happens at the organism-environment interface. That is the name of the game, folks. If you're interested in the creation-evolution controversy, adaptation, how organisms fit into their environment, is really where everything is at. And so this is a tough talk. There's going to be a lot of quotations. There's going to be things from scientific texts and all kinds of stuff. But John Johnson told me, you guys are what?
Cutting edge, maybe.
Brilliant. Cutting edge. That's right. Brilliant. Cutting edge. I just have to keep reminding you guys. You guys are what? Brilliant. Cutting edge. All right. So, I always have to remind the brilliant people that they're brilliant. But anyway, so that's it. So you can go up here on the screen. And we'll just jump right into it. All right. There's the debate. The whole debate question is this. Limited change by natural or designed mechanisms, which is what we as creationists would hold to. Limited change. Natural mechanisms allow limited change versus unlimited gradual change by strictly natural mechanisms, which is the whole basis of evolutionary thinking. That's the whole basis. So, this is a teaching lecture, and I'd like you to have an apologetic point. When you want to talk with your friends, this is the main point. The origin of a creature's ability to reproduce variable, heritable traits. Wow. Already it's like deep. Reproduce variable, heritable traits and diversify is innate and resists being explained by natural means. And all of those things are going to sound quite natural and normal, but believe me, they're going to be resisted. This is the heart of the creation-evolutionary controversy. Where did the ability to reproduce come from? How do you get variable traits, and how do you get them passed on to your children or your offspring, whatever you are? And then how do those enable organisms to fit their environment? That is what we're really going to be talking about today, and nobody has really been talking about this in any depth. Well, 1859, I just went to a debate last week with a thoroughgoing evolutionist and he didn't even get the date of Charles Darwin's book right. 1859, he produced this book, On the Origin of Species by the Means of What? Natural Selection. And I guarantee you everything, and I mean absolutely everything, 100% of main evolutionary teaching is going to pivot on natural selection. And we're going to, at the end of this talk, when someone comes up to you and they ask you, what is natural selection and what is it supposed to do for evolutionary thinking, you'll be able to tell them what natural selection is and what it does on evolutionary thinking. And Charles Darwin, way before he started writing the book, Origin of Species, he had a really tough challenge. He faced an extraordinary task. His task was to explain how something so huge as the diversity of life on Earth could display features that clearly looked like they were selected by a designer, that they would clearly look like they were selected by an intelligence, but not God's intelligence. Now, let me see, if I give you that as a homework assignment, here's your homework assignment. I'd like you to come up with a way to explain how hands, feet, brains, everything that you see on all those creatures up there have features that look like they were selected by intelligence, but you cannot in any way appeal to God. And you have to come up with a credible explanation for it that can convince a lot of people to believe you. That's tough. That's tough to do. And he did it. He came up with a way to try to get people to believe all of these things were chosen, but not by God's intelligence. So what he needs is a source of non-divine, that means not God's, choice-making intelligence. Choice-making intelligence. Because the ability to make a choice indicates volition. Volition, a deliberative action, an intention. And only intelligent things can make choices. Only intelligent things can make choices. Only intelligent things have intent. And so he needs a source of non-divine intelligence. He needs an inanimate substitute God. So you take the brain out, and you still have a way to make choices. And his extraordinary, clever explanation was natural selection. So nature makes the selection between things. So right off, we find that natural selection has a really big job in evolutionary thinking. Jerry Coyne, in his definitive work, Why Evolution is True, said this: the theory of natural selection has a big job, the biggest in biology. In other words, there's nothing bigger than this in biology. Its task is to explain how every adaptation evolved step by step from traits that preceded it. So, putting it in simple words, natural selection, as far as it relates to the living world, has to explain what? Everything. Everything. Why is your nose the shape it is? Why is your hair color the shape it is? Why is your cholesterol? Ooh, we don't want to talk about that. Why is your cholesterol bad? Why is your heart condition? Why is the crustacean shell like it is? Why does it have so many legs? Why for everything? Everything. So natural selection, you're already getting the feeling, has to be an all-powerful, pervasive force in order to explain the origination of everything. You know, I'm trying to stomp this. It actually explains every feature of every cell, every nucleotide of all the DNA for every creature that has ever lived on this planet. Wow. Natural selection then has to be pretty powerful. Pretty powerful. There. And that's why it's such an important point. The tough question is, what does natural selection actually mean? Part of what you would say, well, what is natural selection? Have you heard of it? And have you heard of natural selection? You all heard of natural selection. And if I were to say, what do you think of when you think of natural selection? You would say, survival of the fittest. There you go. That's kind of teeing it up. For a less brilliant crowd, I would have had to say the whole thing. Survival of the fittest. There. Survival of the fittest is what everybody thinks of when they think of natural selection. The trouble is, it doesn't necessarily mean that. When we observe that some organisms live longer and some die sooner, and if you live longer, you obviously have a higher chance of passing on your traits, is that what natural selection is? No. This gentleman right here, a famous evolutionist in Great Britain, his name Michael Hodge, wrote a definitive work, Natural Selection, a Historical Perspective. He says, a quite general issue has still received no canonical treatment. What kind of a thing is natural selection anyway? A law, principle, force, cause, an agent, all or some of these things? Nobody really knows. In fact, I can show you scientific papers published in the best journals where in the very same sentence, natural selection is used as a cause and as an effect. Right in the exact same sentence. And of course it's going to be that way because it's this all-powerful thing. But nobody really knows what it is. But this is an important disconnect that is happening 100% of the time. Natural selection is always used as an external force. It's something that works on creatures, operates on creatures, does something to creatures from the outside, but 100% of the time, whether it's evolutionary teaching or creationist teaching, 100% of the time, it will be defined as the actual outworking of the creature's own innate capacities to reproduce variable heritable traits. Let me emphasize this. It is always used as an external thing which works on a population of organisms. But when you try to define it, It will always be defined in terms of what creatures themselves do innately. Now that is a big problem. You can't have something which is innate to you, endogenous to you, operating on you from the outside. And everybody is missing this. Creationists and evolutionists, they're all missing this disconnect. It is always used as an external force, but defined in terms of the creature's ability to reproduce variable heritable traits. That's what the problem is. And so organisms themselves have to make the adaptation nature. So what is natural selection really expected to explain in nature? So if I were to ask you already, based on what we've already heard, natural selection should be expected to explain everything in nature. But specifically, it's meant to explain this, design. Design. Daniel Dennett, 2005, I'm going to give you five quotes in a row, all from leading evolutionists. We don't read the whole thing. The fundamental scientific idea of evolution by natural selection is not just mind-boggling. Natural selection, by executing God's traditional task of designing and creating all creatures. Boy, natural selection must explain how all creatures were designed. How did a horse in their evolutionary worldview go from four toes to one toe? Natural selection. How were your eyeballs created? Natural selection. How were the cells making up your eyeballs created? Natural selection. Natural selection will explain everything, but specifically, God bless you. The design of things. There. William Provine, you've probably heard of him, a famous evolutionist at Cornell. If natural selection explained adaptation and evolution by descent were true, then the argument from what? Design was dead. The argument from design was dead because natural selection explains the design of everything. Jerry Coyne, a professor at the University of Chicago, says this. This is probably one of the most important quotes. Everywhere we look in nature, we see animals that, look at this word, seem beautifully designed to fit their environment. Whether the environment be the physical circumstances of life, like temperature and humidity, or other organisms, competitors, predators, and prey, that every species must deal with. It is no surprise that early naturalists believed that animals were the products of a celestial design created by God to do their jobs. Oh, this is so important. When you see birds fly, do their wings look designed for flight? Sure, they clearly look designed for flight. When you see a fish swimming through the sea, does its gills look designed to extract oxygen out of the water? Yes, they clearly look designed to do what they're supposed to do. I know there's some people who are working for Boeing here. These things look designed, and therefore they speak of a designer. They speak of the designer. Evolution is going to replace the designer with natural selection. Darwin dispelled this notion in The Origin. In a single chapter, he completely replaced centuries of certainty about divine design with the notion of a mindless, materialistic process, natural selection, that could accomplish the same result. It's hard to overestimate the impact of this. So, let's make sure you guys are following along. In this one worldview, you see designed creatures, and you say the design came from God. In this other worldview, you see designed creatures, and you say design came from natural selection. Natural selection. So, natural selection becomes what?
the substitute God. The substitute God, the substitute designer. And that's why you, if you were going to talk to an evolutionary friend, you would might point to the bird's wings, and you would say, don't they look designed? And you would use the argument from design. This evolutionist over here would know, he would refute it with natural selection. So here's a quiz. I told you this is going to be a tough lecture. Of the two words, natural or selection, which one is the more important word? Natural or selection?
Selection.
Selection. Wow. You guys are brilliant. You are the first group that nailed that. Because natural, certainly natural means no God, right? Natural means no God. But the important word is selection, because selection implies the ability to think, the ability to choose. You're right, choose. But only thinking things choose. Only things with an intelligence can make a choice. And now he's saying nature can choose with no brain at all. And that's how you can get God's intelligence out and slip another type of intelligence in. Now, is that pretty shrewd or what? I'll tell you, this is the shrewdest thing on the planet. There is nothing shrewder than this. What else is there that is so shrewd it can replace the entire concept of God? This is pretty shrewd. I sit there and I think about how Darwin came up with this. And you know what else is really shrewd about it? It's going to be the substitute God, and everything he's going to define was already built in the creatures. It is the fastest sleight of hand that you will ever see. Natural selection, but it's everything you do yourself. Something that's outside of you, but it's everything you do yourself. No God, nature can think. Nature can select. Nature has an intelligence. And guess what? Nature is always right in this worldview. So now, if you're a believer, you should be getting this creepy feeling about natural selection. You should be getting this feeling like, wow, oh, Douglas Fuyama, he says the same thing. What is natural selection? Why is it a theory? We don't have to read the whole thing, but this is just basically the quote. Before Darwin, the adaptations and exquisite complexity of organisms were ascribed to what? Creation by an omnipotent, beneficent designer, namely God. Guess what happened after selection? God is out, and natural selection is in. And that's what the rest of that quote says. God's out, natural selection is in. I just threw that on just as extra. But the key thing here is, he says natural selection makes the argument from design completely superfluous. Well, let me ask you this, believer. Who makes the argument from design that God exists? Creationists do, but before creationists, who did it? Moses did it. Before Moses, who did it? God did it. God makes the argument from design that he exists. So he's basically saying that God's argument is completely gone. Evolutionists use natural selection to say things only look like they were designed but really weren't. Therefore, natural selection is in direct contradiction to what the Bible teaches. Because the Bible says this in Romans chapter 1. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. For God has shown it unto them. He's shown his existence unto them. How did he show his existence? For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things he has what?
Made.
Even his eternal power and guidance, so that they are without excuse. Wow. You know what this is saying here? This is saying that anybody in any culture at any time can know there is a God, and you don't have to have a PhD in biology to do it. Romans chapter 1 is the chapter where Paul indicts the entire world as guilty before God. It's a chapter where he is saying everybody is guilty before God, and he's saying they can know there is a God by the things he has made. Wow, this is tough right here. They must truly affirm what they clearly see. Look at this hand. Does this hand look like it was designed? Sure it does. It looks like it was designed, therefore you must conclude that this was designed. You must not say it only looks like it was designed, but really wasn't. Second, they must not ascribe something that they don't see. Does this hand look like it was clearly designed? Yes, it does. Okay, I passed that truth. But what happens if I say, Baal designed my hand? What happens if I say, Dagon designed my hand? Then I have failed the truth test. First, you must say it was clearly designed. And second, you must ascribe the design to the true designer. Natural selection forces people to fail both of those truth tests. Now, let me just put it in simple terms. Every culture at any time on this planet has human beings that make things. Every culture has people that make things. They make a basket, they make pottery, they make food, they make clothes. They make things. And when you see things that are made, you know they have a maker. Does my hand look like it's made? Yes. Do I look like I'm made? Yes. Therefore, I have a maker. I have a maker. And at the very basic level, at the very basic level, everybody can know there is a maker. Everybody can know that, regardless of what culture you're in. And that's why Paul starts out with Romans chapter 1, making everybody guilty before God. Okay, natural selection comes in, and it makes this argument from design superfluous. It's saying God's argument is wrong. Therefore, natural selection makes people fail both of those true tests, and there is an unreconcilable clash between natural selection and God's word. Either design in nature reveals a designer, or design in nature does not reveal a designer. In the evolutionary worldview, they would say design in nature does not reveal a designer. The real designer is what? Natural selection. That's the real designer. Wow, this is really important, because they're saying that natural selection explains nature's design without God. And that is striking at the most basic, sorry to stand right in front of you, and fundamental truth in the Bible. Right there. And it is taking away the most basic and fundamental convicting thing that the Lord has built into creation, and that there is a creator. And it's explaining it completely without God. So natural selection has a really big job. Really big job. The question then is, this is the crucial question, is adaptive power external or internal? And this is not just a matter of semantics. This is really important. If I were to say of this young lady right over here, she's the young lady. Okay. If I were to say to this young lady walked out her front door, or this lady walked out of her house, you might say, what makes the difference? She walked out her front door, she walked out of her house, it's just a matter of semantics. Maybe that's right. If I were to say this lady walked out her front door, or this lady was drug out of her house, is that a matter of semantics?
No.
It's not a matter of semantics at all. It goes right to the question, how did she get out of her house? How did she get out of her house? Now this is important. How do organisms make traits that fit their environment? How? Is it something internal to the organisms that was built into the organisms? Or is it something that's conferred by selective pressures pushing on the organisms, causing them to adapt? Is it selective pressures external, or is it something internal? Now that is really an important question, and that's what all the dispute is about between natural selection and design, right here. So, now we're not going to read this whole thing. This is taken right from Charles Darwin in 1872. He says, the production and extinction of past and present inhabitants of the world should be due to secondary causes, which Darwin claims exist external to inhabitants, so quote, as natural selection works solely by and for the good of each being to progress toward perfection, therefore, look what he says, these elaborately constructed forms have all been produced by laws acting where? Around us. It's a secondary cause which is external to the creature. That's what he's saying. Nature is pushing the design of organisms one way or another. Nature is doing it. But do you remember what I said, that disconnect always is? It's always defined, it's always used as what? An external force, and then defined in terms of what? Internal capacities. Look what he says at the very next sentence. These laws, which are acting where? Around us, taken in the largest sense, being what? Growth and reproduction, inheritance and invariability. Wow. Is growth a capacity in you or outside of you?
In you.
Is reproduction in you or outside of you?
In you.
Inheritance in you. Variability in you. And right from the very beginning, he says it's something that's outside of you, and then tricky, he defines it in terms of what's in you. That is pretty tricky. And you know how many people have been missing it for 150 years? Almost all of us. All of us. It's something that it's working outside of you, and it works. Well, of course it works, because it's built into you. It's like a Boeing aircraft that works. They do work. I flew in one on the way over here. And I suddenly have assigned some mysterious things that hold the aircraft into the air, and I overlook all of the design features that were built into the aircraft. Of course it's going to work. It was designed to work. But I ascribed some mysterious forces outside of it. Well, who does this? Who ascribes external things that are really internal? Well, this is a great book. The Design of Life, produced by William Genesky and Jonathan Wells. Anybody ever heard of those guys? They're both intelligent design people. I love this book. But look how it describes natural selection in an intelligent design book. This is the chapter on natural selection right here. And it says this, the Darwinian mechanism of natural selection that controls the evolutionary process is simply the environment's way of weeding out harmful traits and giving beneficial traits free play. Moreover, what the environment deems harmful or beneficial, blah, 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 blah. Now, in this quote right here, I told you this is a toughie, we have to think about these things. Is the environment ascribed thinking abilities? Is he ascribing thinking abilities? What words?
Yeah, sure, what words is he using?
He says, it's simply the environment's way of what?
Weeding
out.
It's an intention.
That's an intention. And you know who's been skipping right over that? We have. You can weed things out because you have a brain. That's how you weed things out. because you have a brain. But now the environment can weed things out. What else can the environment do? It says, moreover, what the environment deems beneficial and harmful. Wow. Now the environment can deem stuff on things. It can actually think here. Now, can everybody see how, if you're not reading this stuff very closely, you have just ascribed God-like abilities to what? The environment. The environment. There. Well, they do it. Hey, here's a great website, the Institute for Creation Research. I work for them. They're my boss. They send me a paycheck. Look what it says here. Natural selection can only do what? Operate on. It can only operate on. So it's operating on you in terms of your ability to reproduce variable heritable traits. How slick is that? It's operating on him, but it's defined in terms of everything he can do himself anyway. That is a great sleight of hand that natural selection is doing here. That's what it says right there. So, the environments are always falsely ascribed agency. And that is why all supporters of natural selection, whether they're creationists or evolutionists, they always assign exerting selecting agents that can select for or select against, operate on, pressure, favor. All of those words, how many of you have heard selection favored this trait? Selection didn't favor that trait. Of course, that doesn't explain anything. Doesn't explain. But as soon as I say it favors, it doesn't favor, I'm giving it intelligent abilities. I'm giving it intelligent. You know who uses these words? Creationists and evolutionists, they both use them identically. They both ascribe this power to them. Selection always happens to organisms from the outside, but that's never supported by data. Never supported by data at all. Alright. So, the point thing on this is, natural selection becomes something imposed from the outside, but growth, reproduction, and inheritance are not laws acting around us. They are things that are already operating within you. And this is a quote that a creationist is currently using. Selective survival based on traits. We're going to find out why that doesn't make any sense. Selective survival based on traits. So, if you were to just read these sentences very quickly right up here. Natural selection favor a larger body. Natural selection picks out with unerring skill the best varieties. Natural selection can act as a selector. Natural selection can act to shape the course of. Natural selection is a specialization process, or that which natural selection did not punish in the absence of predators. Every one of those sentences were written by creationists. Every one were written by creationists except one, which was written by Charles Darwin himself. Try to find the one written by Darwin as opposed to the one written by the creationists. You can't pick them out. You can't tell the difference. Actually, it's the second one up there written by Charles Darwin. Selection picks out with unerring skill. But every other one, you can't tell the difference. So we as creationists, we want there to be a difference. We don't want to ascribe abilities to the environment which are really aren't there. So, natural selection explains design without God. We have to apply a real test to expose it. Since selection is defined by some as a design process, how does it really compare to what real engineers really do? Wouldn't that be a good test? How many of you think that if you put this to the test, and you compare natural selection as opposed to what real engineers do, that natural selection is going to stack up? It isn't. It's not going to stack up. And this is how we start to refute it. If it's going to explain design without a designer, let's just see how it stacks up to a real design process. Excuse me. Right there. In biology, what are problems and what are solutions? Well, I'm just going to go through this very quickly here. Environments right here are only problems and opportunities, and evolution, of course, by natural selection, is meant to find optimal solutions to the problems that life throws up. Let me explain that. You guys live down here at sea level, and so you have an abundant amount of humidity, and it seems like you have an abundance amount of rainfall. No. Okay, you have an abundance of rainfall. Could the abundance of rainfall that you guys get up here in Seattle, could that be a problem for some organisms? Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure it could be a problem. If you live in Phoenix, Arizona, where they don't get an abundance of rainfall, could the dry conditions be a problem to organisms? Yes. You guys live down here at sea level, but there are some organisms that live at 14,000 feet in the Himalayan mountains. Could the change in atmospheric pressure be a problem to some organisms? Yes. What I'm saying is this. Environmental conditions, temperature, pressure, humidity, all of those things, they are just conditions that exist. They can either be an opportunity or they can be a problem. And organisms must make traits that solve the problems in order for those organisms to live there. Does that make sense? Okay. There's another aircraft company other than Boeing out there. One of them was called Lockheed. Ever heard of Lockheed? Lockheed made an aircraft called the SR-71, which could fly really high and really fast. Are there different environmental conditions where it flies as opposed to a 737? Of course there are. How did you get an SR-71 to fly that high and that fast? How? Engineers knew what the problems were at those altitudes and those speeds, and they designed a plane that solved those problems. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Real engineers made a plane that solved those problems. If you are an organism and God wants you to fill the earth, He's going to have to build into the organisms the ability to solve problems, just like engineers do it. Just like engineers do it. There. So, life forms. Richard Lewontin, a famous geneticist at Harvard University, he's still alive. I never met him when I was there. Are more than simply multiple diverse. However, organisms fit remarkably well into their external world. And it goes on to say, they have morphologies, that's body shapes and physiologies, and behaviors that appear to have been carefully and artfully designed to enable each organism to appropriate the world around it for its own. The key word here is this. Organisms fit their environment. Does a 737 fit an environment of 70,000 feet of altitude?
Nope.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't fit. And I know some people are here from Boeing. It doesn't fit that environment because a Boeing 737 doesn't have the traits to fit that environment. Is everybody following me on this?
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the right traits to fit. If you have the right traits, then you can fit your environment. By the way, let's go back. Oh, I'll just do it right here. We need to stop defining fitness in terms of death and survival, and we need to see it in terms of functional ability. In the evolutionary world view, death and survival are everything because natural selection is survival of the fittest. It's survival of the fittest. Yeah. But organisms were able to adapt to the world before the fall. Before the fall. Before there was death. So, fitness really means that organisms have traits that fit. And SR-71 has traits that fit that environment. A Boeing 737 doesn't. So it isn't death and survival. It's merely what traits you have as opposed to the traits that you don't have. And we need to see organisms in this designed sense. There. So even before the fall, that, as I was saying here, organisms had to make tricks that fit their environment if they were going to fill the earth. So fit means a problem solved. There. Fit, everybody can see that organisms solve problems. There's no lack of evidence that organisms can generate traits that fit their environment. As it says, there's a lack of evidence of a selector or something selective force. Now, when it comes to solving problems, engineers are active. The problem or the need is passive. Engineers do what only they can do. They create an informational framework to direct something to meet a need. That's why engineers get paid what they do, because they come up with good ideas to solve problems. And how they do that is they see a need, they create information, they make a plan inside of their mind, they pick characteristics that fit the need, they do all of these things. In other words, engineers select one solution and they reject other solutions. They select one type of material, they don't select another material. They select one plan and not a plan. They select a process and not a process. Does everybody see what engineers are doing? They're making a selection process. Let me ask you this. If an engineer comes up with a plan in their choice-making ability when they're selecting, is it guaranteed that the engineer's plan is going to work? No. Do a lot of the plans fail? Yes. They fail. But the plans were still designed. The ones that succeed and the 10 others that failed. They're still designed. They succeed and they fail. So, environmental selection has never been observed. So here's a need. These are some dudes in South America. They're dissolving gold in a cyanide solution. That's not good for your health to do that. And they were getting sick. So how do you do that? Well, engineers come in and they will make a plan to solve that problem there. There we go. Oops, it's kind of slow on that. Go back. Yeah, this is a little slow there. All right, this is it. Engineers make plans. The designer's plan fit the need. I was up in Alaska, and I was doing this lecture at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and someone came up to me, and some gal came up to me, and she said this, "Well, in a way, it could be said that the need selected the plan." Is that true? No. This is a smart group. That isn't true. That's totally not true. If there's a problem out there and I come up with a solution that solves the problem, did the problem select its solution? No.
Otherwise it wouldn't be a problem.
Right, it wouldn't be a problem. The problem doesn't select anything. The problem just is. It just is. It's just out there. It doesn't think. The engineer's solution either solves the problem or it doesn't solve the problem. Now we'll see if this goes through this again. So, is that advancing there? It'll do it. All right. What the problem is with evolution is you have a need and you have a plan, and there are plans, and a plan can meet the need or a plan couldn't. If a plan meets the need, you could say the designer's plan fit the need. That's totally legitimate. You can't say that the need selected the best fitting plan. Wow, this is going to be important because that's what evolutionists are going to say when an organism makes a trait that solves a problem in the environment. They're going to say the environment selected the trait. That's what they're going to say. They're going to immediately say the environment selected the trait, and in their worldview, needs select the best fitting plan. And as soon as you say that the need selected its plan, you just ascribed intelligence to an inanimate thing. You immediately did it. Now I'll just jump ahead and I'll just tell you exactly what the next slide is going to say. There's a plan, there's a need over here. I'm an engineer. I really am an engineer. I make a plan that solves that problem. The problem did not select my plan. My plan either succeeds or fails in solving the problem. That's what happens. In the evolutionary worldview is this. There's a problem out there. Maybe it's a lot of rainfall. That's the problem.
An organism makes a trait, produces a trait, that solves the problem of living in a lot of rainfall. And guess what that organism does? It moves into the environment and it lives here, quite happy. The evolutionary worldview would just say, the environment selected the traits. Which is the exact opposite of what really happens in this position. Okay, here's a golf course. I don't golf.
That looks kind of tough. And I'm going to say, okay, that looks tough. Here's the pin right there. Here are the lambs to the slaughter. This is the San Diego Golf Association here on that. This guy has the longest hole-in-one recorded in history. He hit it like over a hill and it landed in the hole on that, on there.
What would you do if I said, these hazards select for good golfers? These hazards select for good golfers. Would that be legitimate? No. The hazards don't select for good golfers. What if I said, golfers' skills are due to these hazards? Is that true?
No.
No, that still isn't true. They're not due to the hazards. What would you do if I said this? Good golfers overcome these hazards. Is that true?
Yeah.
That is true. That is totally true. It's the good golfers who overcome these hazards. So the ability to overcome a problem is where? In the environment or in the golfer? It's in the golfer. It's in the golfer. Well, in the evolutionary worldview, these are not just silly semantics. In the evolutionary world, we must properly identify where the power really lies. Hills, sand traps, water, they just exist. The ability to overcome them is innate to the golfers. Well, that's the same thing as in the evolutionary worldview. You just take those things out and you replace them with a typical environment there, and you have to properly identify temperature, humidity, predators, good predators, and so on. They just exist. The traits that can solve these problems exist in the creature. And you see the picture of Darwin's finches there. Those finches have genetic information inside them already to produce all different types of beaks. The environment did not put that information there. The environment does not select for those beaks. The information, just like the golfers, and the ability is already in the organisms. It is not conferred by the environment. So, environmental selection has never been observed, and if you do that, you just ascribe intelligence to something inanimate. And in the environment evolution worldview, that DNA and the traits and the need are just environmental changes. And in their worldview, they say environments selected for the fittest traits. Have you ever heard that phrase? Sure you have, because they use it all the time. And environments, therefore, can naturally select, act on, and favor things. And select, therefore, is the key to understanding Darwin's link between the intelligent world and inanimate things. Because people know that selecting is evidence of volition, a special choice-making ability implicit to intelligence. The ability to solve problems is inherent to the organisms. And if you're a believer, and I would ask you tonight, where did that information come from? You would say it came from God. The real designer put that information in them. Just like the SR-71, able to fly up there. And that's why select is the important word. It's this ability for environments to favor or act on things. So, the right question. Is the concept of exogenous natural selection rooted in reality? Is that even true at all? Well,
This is Ernst Mayr. He's passed away, but he was a famous evolutionist. In his definitive book, What Evolution Is, he says this. Let's just read the part in the bold. The conclusion that these favored individuals had been selected to survive requires an answer to the question, who does the selecting? In the case of an artificial selector, it is indeed the animal or plant breeder. But look what he says. But strictly speaking, there is no such agent involved in natural selection. Isn't that an interesting confession? When you go to push for one, there really isn't any agent involved in natural selection. Okay, does that guy fit into his environment?
Yeah.
He fits his environment pretty good. He has something called mossy oak on. He needs to do something with that soap. That doesn't fit.
Yeah.
I think the microphone is kaput. That's all right.
Oh, he has to swap out the thing that
he has. Keep talking. Because all you need to do is look at the pictures. If I were to ask you this question right here, at the organism-environment interface, where does the intelligence and the power to fit that environment reside? Is it in the organism, this man, or is it in the environment? That's the test question. Okay, quick question. While he's doing this, why does that guy fit in the environment really good? Did the environment select for him, or did he select things that fit the environment?
He selected things. Whoa, there we go. We're back in business. He selected things that fit his environment. He was the active part at the organism-environment interface there. All right. He is the active end at this thing. All right, next slide. Does everybody see this guy? Now he's a marine recon guy. Does he fit his environment? Sure, he fits the environment. And that, why does he fit his environment? Because he selected intelligently things that fit his environment. There's a couple Army snipers here. Do they fit their environment? I'm not even looking around. I'm assuming you're right. Yes. They fit their environment. The reason why all of these guys fit is because they exercised intelligence to pick traits that fit. They have the traits that fit there. All right. What about natural selection and variation? Here we have an environment. This environment has some problems. It also has some opportunities. Here we have an organism. He makes traits. Here we have another organism. He makes traits in that environment. Which one of those is going to overcome the problems of the environment better? This one or that one? The one on the right. And of course, in his environment, he has all those problems, including that problem in his environment. Let's see if you're following along here. Is that eagle a selector? The answer is no. The eagle is just another environmental problem. That's all he is. It could be drought, or it could be eagle. It's just a problem. Does the eagle select? No. The eagle eats the one that it sees. That's what it does. It eats the one it sees. If the eagle could see that one, would he eat it? Yeah. Sure he would. He eats the one he sees. He doesn't select between the two. And there's a big difference there. And so even if you change the environment here, the eagle is just another environmental problem,
And in each of those conditions, just like the snipers in the pictures you saw, the ability to not fit or fit is due to intelligence, which has been built into the creature. And the intelligence is the ability to reproduce fur of various colors. And that intelligence was put in that organism by the Lord. Okay, here's a picture of me climbing some rocks last week. It wasn't a joke. Anyway, is this guy fitted or selected? Okay, if this guy gets to the top of the rock, is he expressing any traits which would help him to get to the top of the rock? What might some of those traits be? Muscles. The women always key on the muscles. I knew that's what you would say. The muscles. Muscles plus the ability to balance and grip and all those kinds of things there. So, if he gets to the top of the rock there, if I were to ask you the question, which traits did the rock or the environment act on, favor, or select? Which traits? The answer is none. None. The environment didn't act on, favor, or select any of his traits. If he gets to the top of the rock and it's successful, the credit goes to who?
Him.
Him. And of course, since we're creationists, we would say by extension it goes to the Lord. That's right. If he gets to the top, the credit goes to him. Then why is it when it's not a human being, but it's an animal who's doing some incredible things, why is it then suddenly we say the environment selected for those traits? Would you hear that? Of course you would. You would hear that instantly. The environment selected for its ability to balance. The environment selected for those hooves. The environment selected for those things. And suddenly, the environment is given credit for designing all of the cool things that are in that mountain goat. If you don't give the credit to the environment when a human being does it, why do we give the credit to the environment when it's an animal? It makes no sense. If this mountain goat makes it to the top of the rock, the credit goes to what? The goat. The goat. And all of the traits that were designed into the goat. That's where the credit goes. Now, you can obviously see we're having a big problem here. So, natural selection, there is no external mechanism imposed on organisms from the outside. Natural selection did not operate on those goats. It didn't favor one goat or the other goat. This is what's happening. Organisms make all different kinds of traits. How many traits are you expressing right now? Give me a number. Are you expressing 10 traits? 100 traits, 1,000 traits, tens of thousands of traits. The answer is you're expressing tens of thousands of traits right now. And everything on your body, you're like an incredible Swiss Army knife. You've got all kinds of traits, but you're better than a Swiss Army knife because every one of your traits can still be varied. It's like flipping out a blade on a Swiss Army knife, and it's the saw, and instead of having 10 teeth per inch, you need 20 teeth per inch. You know what's inside of you? There's information inside of you to make 20 teeth per inch. And one of your offspring is going to make 20 teeth per inch. And if you flip out the blade on the Swiss Army knife and it's a spoon, and instead of needing a teaspoon, you need a tablespoon, inside of you, there's information to make a tablespoon. That's what's cool. Everything about you can be changed. Just look at your nose. The length of your nose can be changed. The size of your nostrils can be changed. How much they flare can be changed. Does it turn up? Does it turn down? That can all be changed. Everything about you is incredibly variable. It's incredibly variable. That's what's so cool. And your children are like you, but they're not exactly like you. Not exactly like you. So, what does all of this mean? I'll wrap this up since we're already 10 minutes after. Go way, way, way back in the book of Genesis to Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. The Lord said to the organisms right after he created them, he said to the organisms, be fruitful, multiply, and what? Fill the earth. Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And guess what he said to Adam and Eve? Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Fill the earth. This was before the fall. Now, quick question. Before the fall, was the earth a static place or dynamic place? It was dynamic. It was dynamic. How do we know it was dynamic? How do we know that the earth was changing? Well, we know the earth was spinning on its axis because he said there would be day and night. And day and night in and of itself makes the earth a what? A dynamic place. The Lord said that there would be stars in the sky to mark off what? Times and seasons. So we know that seasons change the earth. Do you realize that there was winter on the earth? And then he also said to the organisms, be fruitful, multiply, and what? Fill the earth. Well, as soon as an organism who's in this environment moves into this environment, the organism has just done what to the environment? Changed it. He's filled it, but he's changed it. He's changed it. As soon as some ants move into an environment, they start making ant what? Hills. As soon as some birds who are in an environment, they fly into an environment, they start making nests. As soon as dogs who are in some environment move into an environment, they start watering the trees. You see? They start doing all of these things. And as soon as the organisms move into it, they change it. So the earth was always a dynamic place. It was always a changing place. And the changes could be challenges. Now let me ask you a question. Are challenges sinful? No. They're not necessarily. They're not. Challenges are not sinful. Challenges allow creatures to display abilities that overcome the challenges. That's really important. You have abilities to overcome the challenges. So if we were alive on the earth before the fall, and the earth was a dynamic place, you know what we would have seen? We would have seen creatures filling the earth, and the earth would have been constantly changing. And some of those changes would have been very challenging, and we would have said, I wonder how those organisms are going to overcome that. And lo and behold, some of the organisms do, and they move in and they fill it. And we would have seen a never-ending display of these great abilities that the organisms have. And who made those abilities in the organisms? God did. We would have seen a never-ending display of His great creative power as He expressed it through organisms, fulfilling His command to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. And the organisms were designed with powerful, powerful abilities to adapt. You think about how powerful this environment is. Do you want to know something that's powerful enough to take on the environment and win? It's the DNA that the Lord has built into His organisms. The information that He has built into the organisms is so extensive, and it is so dynamic, and it is so powerful that it can take on a drought, to a monsoon, to a freezing cold, to a super dry. It can take on all different kinds of environments and fill them all. And fill every single one of them. And that's why you can go down to the depths of the ocean at those deep sea vents, those black smokers that are tossing out things. And you can find bacteria, the same type of bacteria, living at the bottom of that at nearly frigid temperatures, and some of them living at the top at boiling temperatures. And they have filled every environment in between because they have incredible features. And it doesn't involve death. This is what's really cool. So if we're a population of organisms right here, and you are, and you're expressing variable traits, and you do, and you're able to pass those traits on to your kids, which you do, some of your kids, or some of whatever this organism is, are going to make traits which are able to fit an environment. What does it mean to fit? To solve environmental problems. And we'll just say that's you guys. You make the traits that fit, and you fill it, and you guys stay right where you're at, just as happy as a clam, living where you're living, and it doesn't mean that you live and they die. It just means they stay and they fill this, you stay and you fill that, and guess what? Some of your offspring are going to make traits that are going to fill that environment. And over time, you fill the earth. And it doesn't mean that anybody has to die. You just make traits that fit differing environments. That's really what's happening. And that's why organisms are programmed to fill environments by their abilities to reproduce variable, heritable traits, which was built in them right from the beginning. That's the explanation of what's really going on. So, the next time someone says to you, natural selection does this, you just look at them, stroke your beard, okay, gals, scratch your cheek, or do something, and you just say, show me the selector. Show me the selector. And you're going to get quiet because they've never been asked that question before. And there isn't any selector. They'll say, well, it's just a metaphor. And you say, well, metaphors really can't design. Let me tell you who the real designer is, who really designed this hand. And then you can maybe introduce them to the Lord. That's it. Well, thank you guys for hanging in there. I know this was a tough one. I know this is a hard one, but this is really fundamental. It's really what you need to know, and it's really the explanation for what organisms are really doing. John, thank you very much, and I'll turn it back to you.
Exactly. Right? So going one step further to delineated what natural, why natural selection isn't valid. Even the organisms themselves really do not have a real active role in it, but it's the information that was designed in the first place that really is the cause.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Perfect. And if I didn't explain that clearly, thank you for asking the question. You're exactly right. We, as human beings, we can think and we can do, and actually organisms can do this somewhat too. We can actually change behaviors to adapt, and we can come up with things. And organisms can change behaviors and adapt in other ways. But you're exactly right. The real information is not in any way that the organisms think about doing this, or they don't do about it, any more than your children thought about the traits that they were going to have. They just show up in those things. And this is the key. There's no guarantee that those traits are going to solve a problem. There's no guarantee, it's a contingency. So I've had some evolutionists come back and say, just like you're saying, it's kind of a contingency. Do these traits solve this problem, which is what it really means to fit the environment? And I say, yes, it is a contingency. But then they say, well, see, nature's selecting. But that makes no sense. Because there's a lot of Boeing engineers sitting down there in Boeing, and they're talking out all kinds of designs for things. And whether their designs work or not, in some way, is also a contingency. There's no guarantee that any of their designs are going to solve any of the problems. But what you hit on is exactly right. It's the information behind the design, which is the key thing. And the information in the DNA, just like you're saying, is the information behind the design of that trait, which may or may not solve the problem. Now let me just put in one more parenthetical thing. We do live in a world after the fall, now. So death and survival really is a factor as well. What happens to a population of organisms where the environment may change very rapidly and none of them make a trait that solves the problem?
They die.
They die, they go extinct. That's right. And so extinction is a fact of life in this post-fall world. That's right. If none of the organisms can make a trait that solves the problem, and if the problem is severe enough that it's life or death, they'll die and they'll go extinct. And what's the number one reason why organisms are going extinct today? It's the loss of habitat. Habitats are being destroyed, and 20 species a day go extinct on this planet somewhere. So I'm glad you brought that up. The information isn't really like a choice-making information. The information is a DNA-based information.
I have a question and sort of a point here. Is that a problem I have when I'm talking about intelligent design type things like that, echolocation, bird migration, is that it's very complex, and the evolutionists will say, well, we've already explained that, you know, with natural selection. Well, what they fail to understand or fail to make the point is that was 150 years ago, that the bar was very low as far as what to explain. The cell was thought to be as complicated as a ping pong ball. So it was reasonable to suppose that. Now, we need to turn the tables again, because rather than saying, you know, we have to explain where intelligent design to do this, they haven't ever explained it in the first place, because they haven't explained how an impotent natural selection, that is, it can do the job. So the question is, how do we turn the tables, if you like?
Great. How do you turn the tables on that? They haven't explained it. And two reasons why. Natural selection doesn't explain anything. It doesn't explain anything. If I say this exists because it was favored by selection, or selection positively selected that, or negatively selected that, how is that any different than me saying Mother Nature selected this? Mother Nature favored that. Mother Nature. The word selection is totally circular. It doesn't explain, I mean scientifically, it doesn't explain anything why it exists. And so you need to point that out. Natural selection, you see a favorite actor, that doesn't explain anything. And you now know that the ability to solve problems is inherent to the organism's ability to reproduce variable, heritable traits. In everything in the evolutionary worldview, everything presupposes those three things. In order for life to be evolvable, it must be able to reproduce variable, heritable traits. The question then you ask to the evolutionist who says they've solved it, where did reproduction of variability and heritability come from? That's a good question. And oh, by the way, Mr. Evolutionist, you cannot appeal to reproduction, variability, and heritability to explain your answer. Because that's cheating. That's totally circular reasoning. So they must, if selection is going to explain those things, they have to be able to explain the origin of reproduction, variability, and heritability without appealing to reproduction, variability, and heritability. Please explain that. Because these are important mechanisms of selection. And you know what you'll get for an answer? Nothing. Nothing. Because there is not a scientific paper published anywhere on this planet, anywhere, that shows by experimental evidence a natural explanation for the origin of reproduction, variability, and heritability. There is not a paper anywhere. So you've just got them. And that's why they can't, that's why selection doesn't explain anything, because as soon as you go back to really, really explaining why those microbes can live at the bottom of a vent and the top of a vent, as soon as you go back to explaining why that's there, you're going to go right back to the ability, to the information already in those organisms. That's where you're going to go.
Let somebody else have a turn here.
Yes, sir.
I think it's interesting how both evolutionists and creationists is a faith. You have to have faith to be an evolutionist. You have to, there's faith, of course, to be a
creationist. That's right.
So that fact that, is interesting to me, that they won't admit that it's by faith that they're that they believe what they believe.
That's right. It is both faith. Now, of course, my inference to God is faith. But my study of living things is not faith. So, when I look at my hand, and I kept holding my hand up all throughout the lecture and saying, does this hand look designed? You guys said yes. What were you seeing when you said this looked designed? Well, I'll tell you two things you're seeing. One, you're seeing multiple intricately arranged parts functioning together for a purpose. Just memorize that. All you have to do is say, a lot of parts functioning together for a purpose. That's what you're seeing in a hand. That's what you see in a Boeing engine. That's what you see in a 737. That's what you see in a car engine. Everything that is designed has multiple parts functioning together for a purpose.
Plus a thumb.
Plus a thumb. That's two. I'll throw my thumb as one of my parts. So, these things, multiple parts, only have been observed from an intelligent source. I was just in a debate last week with an evolutionist at Hastings College, and he says, so what if they've only been observed? I'm appealing to things that haven't been observed. Wow. Faith. The second thing you're seeing in my hand, which you don't see, is the information behind the hand. The information is totally immaterial, but it's there. And information has only been observed from an intelligent source. So both the information and the multiple parts have only been observed from an intelligent source. So my deduction that this has an intelligent source is based totally on observable things. My inference that it was God is faith. That's right. Yes, sir.
Hi, good evening. Thanks for doing the presentation. It was excellent. I am a creationist, but most of my life spent myself as a believer in Darwinian evolution. So I'm just kind of putting on my helmet here of, by the way, I used to think regarding evolution. And it seems as if the crux of the presentation is about the issue of referring to the environment as making choices. And I'm trying to understand how this is not a semantic issue. The reason I ask is because, effectively, what evolutionists are doing by referring to the environment or the problem as a choice, a selective, yeah, is that they're using anthropomorphism to try to effectively replace the human need for God. But regardless, what they're trying to describe, from what I understand, is the equivalent of like a sieve that you would use, say, if you're panning for gold. And that sieve represents the problem. So in your example of the eagle, is the eagle choosing? No, the eagle's saying, I like this kind of fur over this kind of fur. But the eagle is choosing what it can see. So in a sense, the eagle in that example serves as the sieve. And to say that the eagle is choosing is an anthropomorphism. But in a sense, it's kind of the same thing. Now, I'm not arguing, there are other problems I have with evolution, but I'm saying that the concept of natural selection is essentially describing a process, from what I understand, that comes from the environment and that is amoral, not immoral, but amoral, and is basically a sieve to the conditions. And so consequently, you might have a series of fish die off that have an expression that make them white because they're in a muddy river, for example, the mud is red. And so existing in the genome is the color red, so some of the fish are red, therefore the white ones die out. This is not using genetic mutation as a mechanism here. But in a sense, that's a problem, as you were talking about. And that problem is causing there to be a change in the environment, or in a sense, a choice. But I understand that that's not actually what the environment's doing. So the reason I'm mentioning this is because when you're debunking the idea of the environment being a choice maker, is that going to effectively derail the Darwinian evolutionist who may concede, okay, I agree, it's an anthropomorphism, it's a metaphor, but what it represents is a real process, and that is the problem is a sieve. I wanted to ask, have I missed something?
No, you're on target. You're on target. And that would be the typical response, that the environment is really like a sieve there. And you're also right that they would use it as an anthropomorphism, and you're probably right that if they're smart enough and they're really on top of their game, they would say, okay, it is an anthropomorphism. But I'm still seeing a process. I'm still seeing a process where there's environmental problems and there's traits that meet those needs or those problems. But evolutionists have two problems that they do with this. First, I could show you, since you're on this, I could show you a dozen papers, just like this, which doesn't treat the environment as a sieve. They will say that the red fish in the muddy water, those traits are due to the environment selecting for them, or due to, those traits are because of, they exist in this case because of. So it's not even a sieve, it is a building process that they would say, and I can show you, I guarantee you, because I've got them, they say these traits are due to. Second, the sieve, and that, we'll let
you, I'm sorry.
That's okay, no problem.
It was great.
Oh, you're welcome. The sieve analogy is, it's partially right, but it also fails. The sieve is okay if you look at it as like one of those shape cubes that little kids have. It's a box that has stars, squares, circles, and things in those there. And the traits are like the stars, circles, and squares. Everybody know what I'm talking about? Those little shape cubes, and the kids push those in and those things. Evolution, and this is where it's not semantics, it's where the power really lies. Evolution would have the environment selecting for a star or a square or a thing. But that's not totally true. It is true that the environment will maybe make a square. But what's really happening is the organism that makes the square trait, it's not selected for, it literally fills and moves into that environment. The power is in it, and it is filling the environment. It's moving in. It makes a trade that solves that problem. There is a fitting process going on. But the, as I said, the crucial question is, where does that adaptive power reside? It's innate. And so the organ, you're right, there is this fitting process going on, but the organism is like going in that shape cube. It's moving into the environment, and the adaptive power is inherent and innate to the organism. And that's really the crux of the issue, is where is that adaptive power? In the evolutionary worldview, they would put a lot on selective pressures. Pressures, pushing the organisms on. But that's not true. Organisms are not reacting in a passive sense. Organisms are proactive in solving problems, like an engineer solves a problem. And this is and the traits exist independent of environmental pressures, because I could also show you from a dozen different situations easily where traits to solve an environmental problem exist in the population before an environmental condition ever existed on the planet. Their traits were already there before the condition ever existed. So,
what we haven't brought up here today is the key thing about information theory. What if the evolutionists say, because when we went to the presentation, the skeptic group on Tuesday, and all they think is that we just had one little thing, one created information, like nylon digesting bacteria. That's enough to explain all of nature. How does your opponent try to identify the information theory problem?
They don't, generally. They would say, and in this sense, you know, it's kind of hard to, I don't always go along with the creationist response. So you have a genetic mutation and that's expressed in your children. They would say, new information. It's new information. And many creationists would say, well, no, it's not really new functional information. It's just a variation on existing information. But I don't necessarily buy that response. Even if I was an evolutionist, if I put on my evolutionary helmet right now, I would say, I don't necessarily buy that, because it is new information. It wasn't there before, and now it is new.
Yeah, so we're
so I would respond,
we're gonna have a problem if we say there is none.
You kinda have a problem if you say no, it's not new, because it is new. It is new. But I would respond to information theory in two ways with that. One, going back to even what your point is this. What if in the Lord's programming of organisms to make traits, to fill environments, what if, as part of the programming, there were mechanisms built into the program which could generate new information in and of themselves that would enable them to fill new environments?
Well, Chris here is a biologist. He's told me that some species exchange information, right?
Sure. Some species exchange information. Okay, this is really cool. Hopefully it isn't boring. This is kind of cool. What if, as part of your design mechanism, you had portions of your DNA, which sometimes could be changed accidentally by a random mutation, but what if you had portions of your DNA which was designed to mutate, and in the process of mutating, you express new traits. And the new traits do what? They solve problems, enabling you to fill new environments. Wouldn't that be cool? Yes, that is cool. That's what's really in your DNA. You have places in your DNA which are genetic hotspots which appear to be designed to generate like a random number. And you use these random number results to get your new traits. Now that's kind of cool. And that's really what happens. So not all mutations are unprogrammed or undesirable. There are certain parts of your DNA which actually program. Is everybody following me when I say a random number generator? If you want to get random results, your program will make a random number, you'll put it in the results, and you'll use it. Your DNA does that. But the second way I'd also respond to the evolutionists is this. If you're going to try to build the genome as a whole, the genome functions like a massive amount of information. And all of the information that is stored, that is put in a stored way, it's all built within the framework of a thought. A thought. So right now, you're thinking of a response to me. As you think of a response to me in your mind, which is a thought, you have those thoughts, and those thoughts are telling you which words to select to respond to me. The thought is the framework of which you put all of the words, and correspondingly all of the letters, together. It's the thought which builds the framework for putting the information together. And in all of human experience, you've never been able to build a sentence or a paragraph by randomly putting in letters without a thought to guide them. There's always a thought that guides it behind the information there. So, how I respond to my evolutionist friend, just on the pure basis of this, there's never been a time where any human, where any information has been built up through the random exchanges of letter or letter or letter. All information is always built within the context of a thought, a real, tangible thought which guides a selection of those words. Now that's pretty powerful, and they're going to have a hard time getting past that.